You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, my guest is Richard Lloyd. Richard Lloyd is a founding member of the band Television, and he's also recorded many solo albums, as well as playing with John Doe, Matthew Sweet, and many others. Before we get started with our interview, here's a little bit of Richard Lloyd in action, playing with his seminal new wave band, Television, from their LP, Marquee Moon. This is a song called Friction.
But not let up. It's just a little bit back from the main road, where the silence spreads and a mended holds.
That was the band Television, featuring my guest, Richard Lloyd, on guitar. Richard Lloyd has just written a memoir. It's called Everything is Combustible, Television, CBGBs, and Five Decades of Rock and Roll. Richard Lloyd, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm honored.
So when you were born, you were... I want to make sure I have this straight. You were a little groggy because your mother had been sedated, and you feel that some of the narcotics that she'd been given came through your umbilical cord, and then the doctor had to slap you because you'd been breathing embryonic fluid and your airways weren't open right away. Now, I think a similar thing...
that's what happens with everybody's birth.
Oh, yeah, I know. I think it might have happened to me. But you have a specific memory of it?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's odd.
I remember getting smacked, and then they played around with me and they put a weird little hat on my head, and I didn't like that. I remember that I didn't like the hat they put on. Now, then thinking back on it, it's like confirmation, you know. The doctor slaps you and says, "Welcome to the world. This is what you can expect from it."
Do you think it's unusual that you have such a sharp memory of this event?
Yeah, I have very sharp memories. In fact, I think I have room memories. Because I remember being in a place that wasn't confined by gravity. And the more I think about it as I'm older, the more I realize that must be floating in the amniotic fluid, you know, rather than a former life or anything.
Uh-huh.
Because the brain forms, and, you know, in the last trimester, you're pretty aware. I think the trauma of the birth, you know, knocks that out of a lot of people, but I've always been a very, let's say, willful person, so I don't think it knocked the sense out of me.
Yeah, and you said in your book that you didn't particularly feel like a kid or a child.
No, I was never, I became a kid by general request.
Because they wanted you to be one, so you became one.
Yeah, you know, my mother expected a baby, and so eventually I figured that out and became a baby for her. And then a child for, you know, the other children, they didn't seem to have the cognizance or the consciousness that I had, and I couldn't explain anything to them because they looked at me like I was nuts. So I just played with them in a sort of, you know, playing as a child, and I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed being a child, but underneath it all, I was an old soul, I guess you call it.
Well, did you feel that they were inferior, or?
Oh, God, just asleep, sort of hypnotically entranced, certainly not inferior. I was stuck in the same body as they were. You know, there's no feeling of, there's not a real feeling of superiority there. There's just more a feeling of awkwardness, of having, you know, a greater sense of self in the scheme of things. And I couldn't understand why children were sometimes evil. You know, they were nasty. Kids are notorious. And I was like guileless. So my mother looked at me one day and she said, "You've got to get some savvy or you won't make it in the world. You know, the world will tear you to pieces." And I thought, like, oh, no, that's a terrible idea. I got to keep honest, you know. And that's one of the reasons why I remember everything, because I don't lie to myself, and I don't tend to lie to others unless it's a polite, you know, does this dress make me look fat kind of courtesy. You know, I used to be pretty blunt, and people don't like that. So you have to tone it down a bit and be courteous, you know.
Were you, when you were a kid before you became a musician, what kinds of music did you listen to, and how did music affect you?
Well, my mother sang the songs of the day to me. I remember her singing "Tootsie, Don't Cry," "Tootsie, Bye Bye," which I guess was a hit in 1950 or 51. And then I had a little baby toy piano that I played. And I played all sorts of things, inventions on it, you know, with two fingers, and there's sometimes three fingers. And I couldn't figure out, I could figure out one note always sounded good. And two notes together always sounded good, or most of the time, but three notes together, you know, sometimes they sounded good and sometimes they didn't. And I wanted to learn the piano, but we were too poor for me to have lessons. And I had this little 28-key piano, and I played it for a couple of years. And that was my first musical experience. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I just didn't want to grow up, you know, and enter the world of responsibility and where you get a job or a career that hardens around your ankles like cement, you know. So I became a musician by default.
So you wouldn't have to do all those other things. Did you feel, you know, oh, someday I'll have to wear a suit and think, you know, because that's what grown-ups
do. No, you know, I worried about it, but, you know, and sometimes I wish that had been born a female just so I could avoid that whole, like, quote-unquote man thing. And I think men are really, a lot, are really undesirable kinds of animals. Going to sports events and fighting and, you know, all this politics and all this other crap just doesn't suit me.
You're not a fan of sporting events?
Not a fan of what?
Sporting events?
No, I'm not. The only one I liked when I was a kid was Demolition Derby. The last car that could move wins. I used to watch Demolition Derby, but, you know, I didn't like sports where somebody lost and somebody won and gloated, or lost and was a sore loser, and, you know, even ping pong. Forget about it. I like chess, but, you know, I'd rather lose than win.
You'd rather lose? Well, it's easy to lose in chess, I think.
Oh, yeah. That was the only game when I had my son that I told him, I didn't tell him. But, you know, everything else, like he wanted to knock me out. So I bought some boxing gloves for us, and I always went down, you know, up from my knees. I would collapse on the floor, and he won, you know. Kids have to win, you know. But when I taught him chess when he was like four, I said, this is the game I'm never going to, like, fake it. You know, I'm not going to let him win. And about 2 weeks later, he beat me.
How old was he?
He was four or five. Serious. He has chess trophies that were taller than him at the time. Now he's into the computer field. He's 25 and he works in New York. So I'm going up there pretty soon to do some shows and I'll get to see him, which is great.
You don't live in New York? You do, don't you?
We moved to, my second wife and I moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee, of all places. That's the last place on earth I would ever want to move, have wanted to move, but it's a wonderful place. It's just got the craziest name, Chattanooga. I mean, hello, I guess it's a Native American term, but it's choo-choo, you know, Chattanooga choo-choo.
Right.
Is all I could think of.
That's all I can think of now.
But she grew up here and her parents are here and they're like old. And New York just got to be to the point where the rents were just completely outrageous. And we got in a big spat with our landlord that took like two years at court and he finally bought us out of the apartment. And by God, you know, we thought, well, let's get out of the city. And Chattanooga was her choice. I followed along, and it's a great city. It really is. It's halfway between Nashville and Atlanta. So I'm close when I need to for Southeast touring and stuff, which is great. But I've had to go to New York a number of, like more often than not, to do various things like gigs and book signings, et cetera. So I'm going there in April to do a tour of the Northeast. And in August, I'll be in the Ohio, Detroit, Chicago, Cincinnati, Dayton, that kind of area. And then maybe in the fall on the West Coast, we'll see. I'm talking with a record company, and I might make a new record in the middle of this year. So I'm looking forward to that.
But it seems like Manhattan is such a part of who you are in this, in your book, Everything is Combustible. It's odd to think of you in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
That it certainly does seem odd to me. You know, the only thing I get, I get to drive here, which I like driving, and I never was one of these people who had to drive as a kid because I lived in Manhattan. I didn't have a driver's license until I was 40. And I didn't need one, and I didn't want a car, you know, because in Manhattan, it's just nuts. You just need the subway or a bus or walk. I used to walk everywhere.
Right.
Loved it. Yeah. Still do. I still love New York, but I'm not unhappy that I've moved out. I'm very happy. I'm just happy when I wake up, and I stay happy all day, and I have no gripes or resentments whatsoever.
Well, CBGB's was a place where you spent a lot of time, and now it's it's a store that sells torn T-shirts for $75. You know, it's like an absurd kind of boutique.
Yeah, well, he doesn't sell torn T-shirts. It's not like with safety pins. It's very high-end clothing, John Barbados. I mean, he respects the space. That's true. The CBGB's is a restaurant in Newark Airport. Which is the last place I'd eat, you know, a television sandwich or a Talking Heads omelet. Ridiculous.
I went to CBGB's a few times, although I never saw television there, unfortunately. But, but it was quite a scene.
When were you there?
I saw in 1980. I saw John Cale and Nico there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was
cool.
That was fun. Nico came on at about 4 a.m. or something.
it was still happening then in '80. Most of the first bands had been picked by record companies. Then you make a record, and then you're on tour, so you can't really play CBs anymore. And then the second wave comes in, and then, you know, people from all over the world wanted to play CBGBs. I remember some tourists coming from France, and they, instead of going to the hotel, they went to CBGBs. They walked in and went, ooh, this is these famous CBGBs? This is a, you know, a dump. Yeah, and it was. That was why we picked it, so nobody would want to take it from us.
Was it hard to get people to come to CBGBs when you were first playing there?
In the beginning it was, yeah, because people wouldn't, they were afraid of the bums, because we were under a flop house, CBGBs, and there were always bums sprawled out on the street, you know, and trying to get up their $3 for a cot that night or whatever. You know, every once in a while somebody'd knock over their wine, it would pour through the ceiling onto the stage or whatever, and the dog crapped on the stage, the Hilly's dog. So, yeah, it was tough to get the suits down there or people from, for a while, you know, it was like the younger brother to Max's back room, you know, because Max's back room is where all the fabulous people went. I used to hang there. And then CBGB's kind of took over with the young professionals. It wasn't just the musicians. That's the astonishing thing. There were budding photographers and journalists and authors and, like yourself, radio people and, you know, people who went into the record business later. And it was very exciting, you know, because most of the audience, you know, had their own dignity. It wasn't like you buy a ticket to see somebody and they're on stage and you're sitting in a seat, like, you know, with the binoculars.
Right, you're right. You're right there.
You're right there, and it's a great sounding room. It was all wood with a huge long bar, you know, and I used to get free drinks, so I was there every night. Whether I was playing there or not, I kind of ruled the roost, so to speak.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking tonight with Richard Lloyd. He's the lead guitarist for a great band called Television, as well as playing with Matthew Sweet and John Doe and lots of others, and recording many fine solo albums. And he's just written a memoir. It's called Everything is Combustible. Well, you were, according to your book, and I really... love this book, Everything is Combustible.
Thank you. Well, everything is, isn't it?
Well,
except the neutral gases, like helium. Everything else is rusts or is combustible in some way, has chemical activity going on. But that's science, you know.
Right, it's not exactly a science book, but there's a little bit of science in it. There's a little bit of everything in this. There's a little bit of everything in this book, and now it's not exactly a linear. Have you read a lot of other rock and roll memoirs?
Oh sure, yeah, tons. There's a great one by Tony Fletcher on Keith Moon. I love that book. I read Ian Hunter's book. I'm actually not in it, but he mentions the night there where I bumped into Keith Moon. In it, 1972 in Los Angeles. And I've read books on Morrison and the Beatles and not Morrissey.
Right, no.
You know,
Jim Morrison.
From the Doors.
Right.
Morrison and Hendrix biographies and stuff like that. You know, Stones, Beatles.
It's kind of a thing now that a lot of rock musicians are writing their memoirs. But I mean, how did you decide? How did you decide to write yours?
You know, I've been telling stories, and people be like, "You ought to write a book," for years and years, but they were like oral stories. So finally, I couldn't type because it bothered my wrist as a guitar player. I don't want carpal tunnel syndrome, so. I bought a voice recognition software program that in the beginning, version 4, was like a very bad secretary. You had to correct
it. It was like found poetry.
Everything. But now I'm using Dragon, naturally speaking, version 14, which is fabulous and can text out, type out for you, and you just speak 120 words a minute. So I began telling my stories into the computer over a number of years, and I didn't know what to do with them, you know, and I tried to get a an editor or a co-writer or something, but everybody said, like, I took it to David Frick at Rolling Stone, and he said, no, you've got a voice, you should write it yourself. And, you know, Lex McNeil, pretty much the same thing. They wanted to help, but they thought I had such a strong voice of my own, I didn't need any of that. And it turns out I didn't. So I went with a small company in Maine to put out the book, for whom I had written a foreword on a book about John Lennon in the light of the Gurdjieff work. And I said, do you want to see some of my stories? And he said, we'd love to put this out. So that's how that relationship got started. And it turned out very, very well.
Well, it is a beautiful book, but let me ask you about some of the things that happened. So you've met some great people, and including the legendary guitarist Jimi Hendrix, who punched you in the face. Hendrix punched you
in the stomach and the face. It was a flurry. What do they call that in boxing?
Yeah, a flurry, yeah.
Face, stomach, face. Left, right, left. He's left-handed, don't forget. And he punched me with his left in the face, and then the right to the stomach, and then the left to the face. And I promptly sat down and thought, how do I absorb this energy, because it's coming from him? You know, it wasn't just some bully beating me up. It was Jimmy
It was a very
Hendrix.
Famous bully. But he's not really...
He wasn't a bully.
Seems like a very gentle soul. I mean, were you sort of shocked?
He was a gentle soul. He would go off once in a while, especially if you thought you were patronizing him. And we were all drunk, and he was saying, I'm not long for the world. And I was like, Jimmy, you can do whatever you want to do. And I didn't know. I was naive to the point of not knowing he was involved with a gangster manager who, like, you know, threatened his life and stuff like that. Said, you know, someday, Jimmy, you'll be worth more to me dead than alive, and that day will come. Do you like your little fingers to play your little guitar? You'll do exactly as I say. Which was terrible, you know, and I didn't know he was under that kind of pressure.
And so what was it exactly that made him decide to punch you in the face?
I tried to cheer him up.
Well, you know, people hate that, Richard Lloyd.
They hate that. That's right. They like to wallow in the self-pity. Although everything he said was true, he wasn't long for the world, etc. And he was under the guy, you know, under the thumb of management. And it was, you know, a terrible thing and a waste of his future. And I don't think he killed himself, and that's neither here nor there. You know, what I believe is neither here nor there, but, you know, there have been books written about that, you know, aspect of things. I just remember hearing that he had died, and I wore black for a month in respect. But we wore black anyway in New York.
That's right. You wore black for the next 12 years out of respect.
Yeah, something like that. That's
Well, that brings me to another little thing that I got in your book that I thought was interesting. You talked to you're kind of a philosopher, Richard Lloyd, and in your book you talk about death and about mourning of people, and you said that you don't feel mourning.
No, not like normal people or average people, or I don't know what you call these people. Nobody's normal, really, but there's like a social constraint that, I mean, people mourn, but is how much of the mourning is actually for the person who's died, and how much is it is self-pity, like that, you know, woe is me, my mother's dead, you know? I mean, I just don't feel like that. It's like you send the soul off, you know, and say, you know, in your whatever's next, you know, have a good one. A good death.
Do you think of yourself as a philosopher?
I don't use that word, but when asked, of course, I'm into philosophy. That's the love of wisdom. Philos, friend of Sophia, wisdom. Love of wisdom. That's what it means in Greek, from the Greek.
Yeah. Do you have your belief system in your book? That's kind of, I should just let you talk about it. But I mean, you believe in the power of wishing.
I do. I think it's been threadbare with, you know, blow out the candles on your birthday, throw a coin in the fountain, make a wish, and, you know, and nobody really understands the power of a wish that's made from the deepest part of one's earnestness, because those wishes do come true, even if they're impossible. For instance, I would ask people what they had wished for when they were a kid, and did they get it, and, you know, and I got varying answers. And I would ask, well, did you ever wish for something impossible? And you knew you couldn't get it, but you wished for it anyway. And a drummer of mine said, I used to wish I could fly to the moon. And as he said it, his face just completely lost all worry and fear and everything. And I could see him become a child again, full of awe and wonder. And to me, that wish was the one that had come true, because it took 20 years off of his appearance just to talk about it. So in a way, that wish came true, you know? I get very emotional about it.
And you wished that you would be an influential guitar player. You had a specific thing, not just to play guitar.
Oh, yeah, I made a wish when I was 15. I didn't make any before that. And I wished that I could have an that I would enter rock history in some way, shape, or form, have an influence on rock music, or popular music, whatever you want to call it, and have an irreparable impact. And that came true. So that wish got translated into reality. I mean, it took a number of years of living in poverty and just desperation, and playing my guitar behind everybody's back, really, for woodshedding. Like, I used to wish or pray when, you know, you go to bed, you pray for your grandma and your mom and, you know, the people you love and all of that. I used to pray that I could go into my closet while I was sleeping and play guitar for 1,000 years. And the next morning I would have that knowledge. And I don't know how much of that wish came true, but some of it certainly came true. I haven't played for 1,000 years, but I've been playing for 40, and I'm still learning. I just recently started a college-level jazz course, and it's kicking my butt, but it's really great.
So you play the guitar every day?
I play the guitar about 6 hours every day while I'm online.
Oh, so you just, while you're doing things, you're playing?
Yeah, while I'm doing things, I'm playing guitar. I have it plugged in. But I played for many years without an amplifier whatsoever, just a Stratocaster naked, you know, trying to get good.
You're pretty good. I like what I hear, and I always have. My favorite television song is Days. Did you have a hand in that one?
Yeah, I wrote that one.
I love that song.
I co-wrote it. I wrote the basic music that the song is placed upon it, and I wrote the basics for Friction as well, but I didn't get songwriting credit. And I wrote my own parts to a lot of the songs and never got any, you know, Tom's not generous. In fact, I had to threaten to withdraw the music from Guiding Light in order to get credit, and the same with Days.
Other than bringing back the memory of what credit you didn't get, do you like those songs? Do you listen to those songs?
I love those songs. They're beautiful. They're magnificent, and yeah, I like them a great deal. They're two of the most poignant songs on both of those records.
I guess it reveals something about me that I like Days the best of all the Television songs, because I think it's the most melodic, and I think I like songs
right.
like that.
Yeah, me too.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. That was Days by the band Television, featuring lead guitarist Richard Lloyd, my guest this week. He's the author of a new memoir called Everything is Combustible, Television, CBGBs, and Five Decades of Rock and Roll. We'll continue our conversation with Richard Lloyd right after this. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. My guest is Richard Lloyd. He's a great rock and roll guitarist, and he's just written a book called Everything is Combustible, Television, CBGBs, and Five Decades of Rock and Roll. Your first solo album, Alchemy, that was kind of a surprising record at the time because it was so...
Yeah, I let go of all of Television's colors in a way and went and did a record that represented a young man's first record with that kind of romantic nostalgiaism in it. And that was on purpose, that I made a pop, like a pop rock record. And it looks like they might re-release... Somebody might get a chance to re-release it, which I'm very excited about because Elektra would never allow it to be re-released. And now it's in the hands of Warner Brothers and Rhino or whatever. And I think I've got somebody who's convinced them to let it come out again. They just have to figure out, do the numbers crunching and see what they can do. But that record, I'd love to see it reissued.
Would you...
And in fact... I have two bands currently, a New York-based band and a New Jersey-based band. The New Jersey-based band is the people who played on Alchemy, with the exception of Tony Shanahan from Patti Smith's band playing bass instead of Fred Smith. But I have Jimmy Mastro and Vinny D'Annunzio, and they're both on Alchemy. So that's very exciting for me.
In the book, you talk about how the producer of Alchemy kind of locked you out and put keyboards and things that you didn't want on the record, but in the
end... He did lock the door and put keyboards on the record that I didn't want. This is true. Fred Smith woke me up one day and said, Michael's got himself in the studio putting cheesy synthesizer sounds on your record and the door's locked. And I went down and pounded on the door for about an hour. And he wouldn't open the door. And he called Elektra and said, you know, I'm saving the record from Richard, who's into drugs. And I called the record company and I said, the producer is ruining the record for me. You know, and so we stopped production for about 6 weeks. They said, you can get another producer, but you got to pay for it yourself. And I couldn't afford that. So... Alchemy came out as is.
Yeah, you like it. You think it was better the way it was? I mean, would you say take the keyboards off, or do you like the way it is?
A couple of keyboards I would not necessarily take off, but I would change the sounds. You know, like synthesizers, you can change the sounds of stuff.
Uh-huh.
The song Alchemy at the end is all, you know, a production stuff that I didn't go along with. The me, echo, garbage. But other than that, you know, I've come to love the record for itself. You know, I loved it in the beginning when it came out. And Misty Eyes was doing very well on radio and in the Northeast, and could have been a national breakout, but as fate would have it, you know, I was in the throes of my heroin addiction at the time. And they set up a meeting with a big management company. And so many times I've been, you know, I've snatched defeat out of the jaws of success. Or had it snatched out from under me. You know, once another major company was going to sign me and they said, you know, except for the paperwork, you can say you're a such and such artist and we're going to make you huge and blah, blah, blah. And then my manager ruined it at the time. And I had to sue to get out of that contract. Because after like a couple of years with him, I was reduced to having nothing really. But that's in the past as well, you know. I've had a colorful past, and I enjoy the fact of living, no matter what comes along.
Even the bad stuff, you're saying?
Even the bad stuff. You know, I'm a person who, if it's something I haven't experienced yet, yes, I'll enjoy being tied down to a gurney in a mental hospital. I will enjoy going to jail. I've only been to jail for, like, you know, a holding cell, or once for not paying a jaywalking ticket. I was in jail over the weekend, and, you know, as an experience, I benefited from it. didn't mean that I wanted to become a prisoner, you know, like I don't want to do a long stint. I never got a felony or anything like that, you know. Well, I guess I'm lucky because I did enough drugs, and in the drug, you know, we were criminals and saints and adventurers and chemists and doctors to ourselves, all rolled up in one. It was very exciting. But if the police caught you, you know, you would, that would be that. You'd be in prison.
Well, You have a son you mentioned earlier. So, did you encourage your son? You should take LSD and start right now. Or did you? I don't know. How did you feel? I mean,
I let him decide his own. We caught him with pot when he was like 15, and you know, and I can't call the kettle black. You know, but he's a good guy, and he made it through. And I don't, you know. I think everyone should have to take LSD to graduate high school.
That should be a requirement.
Wipe out all that societal, you know, garbage they pump into you, and open up your mind, you know, and then go to college or not. I went to college for 3 days and decided it was like another high school, you know, with cliques and relationships and all this garbage going on, and it didn't interest me, and it wasn't going to help me. You know, I didn't want to go to a music college either because I didn't want to get stuck with the sort of technical know-how that they push into you. You know, now I'm older and I can see the value in reading music, and I don't read music, but I'm starting to. And like I said, I'm taking a jazz course, which is very challenging to me in jazz improvisation. Well, they don't bend strings, and I'm a string bender. I'm a I try to strangle the guitar. Beat the guitar up, you know. It's a wonder the guitar stays in tune with what I do to it.
Do you listen to much contemporary music?
I don't. You know, there comes a period where I listened to so much music when I was younger. I mean, just so much that I, like, you can imagine a sponge as big as your room, and it's saturated. It's like full of music. And when I sit down, I leave, wet musical footprints on the floor. And when I walk, I leave behind musical footprints, you know? So you put another drop on top, another one comes out the bottom. So I've stopped listening to music. And that's surprising to some people, but there are a great number of professional musicians who cease listening to other music because they're doing their own, and or, you know, they're saturated. I mean, I'll listen to contemporary radio while I'm in the car or while somebody, but on my own, I can go for a year without listening to another piece of music, and I'm fine.
Do you think that television and Richard Lloyd records sound better on vinyl than on CD or MP3?
When they first did the first mastering of Marquee Moon, I cried because the record didn't sound as good as it did in the studio. And I thought, scratching a nail across a piece of plastic is something for cavemen, and something better will come along. So when my record player broke, I stopped. That's when I stopped listening to music. It was like 1976 or 77 or 78, somewhere in there. And I appreciate vinyl because of its the warmth that's imbued in it, in the grooves, because of the vinyl compression and tape compression. But frankly, there's a CD remastering of Marquee Moon that actually sounds closer to what we heard in the studio than, it, with the exception of, like, classical, very heavy 180-gram vinyl with deep grooves. You know, those sound fantastic. I have two vinyl records coming out for Record Store Day of my catalog, and I'm excited to hear them. The Radiant Monkey is going to be released, 500 copies, and a record that never came out except as a digital download called Lodestones is coming out on vinyl, and there's like going to be 800 copies limited. So I'm very excited about that on vinyl. Vinyl's the last piece of where you actually possess and own the music. You can get more information on a cover because it's not in a teeny little box. I remember waiting at the record store for, you know, the Rolling Stones new record or the Beatles new record to come out or whoever it was, and being so excited to take that record home and look at the sleeve, and that was all the information, unless you saw them live, that was all the information you ever got about the band. It wasn't like today where you can Google people and read their Wikipedia pages. There was a mystique there, and the records had a deep, deep mystique in them, and I loved that, and it's coming back for some young people, and older people too, but I'm very excited about the young people who have become vinyl files.
Well, I hope they'll all pick up this book. It's called Everything is Combustible, Television, CBGBs, and Five Decades of Rock and Roll. And the author, the legendary Richard Lloyd, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate your support, and thanks for everything.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Richard Lloyd. His book is called Everything is Combustible, Television, CBGBs, and 5 Decades of Rock and Roll. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.